Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century,
join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Happy New Year! Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. I guess I shouldn't say that. This is just our little intro, huh? That's okay. Happy New Year. Yeah. You're still here at the podcast.
Yeah, you are. You are. Christy and I are here ringing in the new year.
Yes, we are. I'm still wearing my Joy to the World hat because it's
I see
like
that.
The,
I wish our listeners could see this lovely hat. Matches your pink headphones.
Yeah, I know. Ninth day of Christmas? I should know this.
Oh, gosh. I should know this as well. Yeah, because it's still Christmastide.
I know, it is.
Epiphany's January 6th. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And so we are still in the midst of Christmastide.
Yes, we are.
So don't grow weary of celebrating.
No, it's still up. It's all still up. I do have a question for you, though.
Okay.
Okay. What is the best swag that like a company or a ministry could give or has given you as like a, hey, promo?
You know, I think of often there's a, so somebody in one of my cohorts, her husband works at this company that does that kind of thing. And she ended up sending us some of their swag. And the thing I love the most is the water bottle I got.
Oh.
It is it's like a nice metal, I think it's like double walled, kind of vacuum sealed. So it keeps the water really, really, you put some ice and some water in there. That thing is cold for like 36 hours.
Ooh,
that's
good.
It's great. Yeah, it's really nice.
Okay, well, I'm gonna up you like 10 times because—
What?
I know.
That's a big claim, Christy.
It is. Okay. You know, Paul works a lot, lots of different ministries. And a ministry that it will rename nameless. How's that? I guess we won't tell who it is, but they gave him something that I was like, what in the world? This is like a Christmas gift. It was one of those ember cups that keeps your coffee warm for like forever. Well, not forever, but it has like a little thing on the bottom.
Built in. Okay.
And then you can like put it on the charger or whatever, but you can take it off the charger and it will keep it a certain temperature connected to your phone. Wow. And they have like their name on the front of the cup. And I was like, can I have that? Can I take that to work? And so I'm going to be supporting with my swag, my coffee cup swag. It's awesome.
Yeah. So Paul got something that keeps the drink hot. And my favorite thing is the thing that keeps the drink cold.
Yeah, there you go.
I guess you could put a hot drink in there, but that feels a little weird to put a hot drink in your water bottle, doesn't it?
No, not if it's like hot cocoa or coffee or something. You should try it. Let us know how long it stays hot.
Okay.
Yeah. With a contest.
It's a nice one. It's a nice one. No, that's a great little swag gift. So
yeah, it was. Really cool. It was like better than his Christmas present I gave him, I think. So
Did he just get a Joy to the World hat like that?
Yeah, you know, Joy to the World hat. Everybody gets one. That's what I should do next year.
Spread the joy.
How was your New Year's?
It was good. Yeah. So we were in Minnesota for a little vacation visiting family. Both my wife and I grew up there and have family there. And so, yeah, that was our New Year. We both, both Deb and I, we've continued our tradition though of going to bed before midnight.
For real?
Yeah. I just don't have time for New Year's. I'm just like, what? Like, what? Like my sleep is important enough to me that I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing staying up this late. Like I'm going to be messed up for 2 days after this. So we went to bed, although it was central time. So I could say, I guess that Eastern time where I live, I did stay up until midnight. So
you should have just watched the ball drop early, like, you know, in New York and then gone to bed. Cause it'd be like 11.
11 o'clock. No big deal. That would have been good. Yeah.
We did a reverse dinner with my family.
What does that mean?
So that means that you have dessert first. You just do it in reverse order.
Okay, that's fine.
And then we had dinner, and then we have this tradition of like putting questions in a balloon, like lots of balloons, uh-huh. and then the kids have to pop them, and everybody has to answer the questions. Oh. So it could be like, you know, what's the best book you read in 2022, or what's a goal you have for 2023? It was fun, and then we danced it out, had a little dance party with all the kids, and
You've got like a whole party. You got so many kids, you have a party like ready to go whenever you need it. Plus,
it's pretty fun.
You've got the personality, Christy, that that our listeners, I think, have come to know and love, just like we have. But that personality that's like, you come up with, like, I'm going to put a little question inside of a balloon, and we pop it, and we, like, I don't know. Yeah. It's just like...
It was fun.
It's like the idea that everybody has, which is like, hey, let's all ask each other interesting questions. But then you put a little of your own spice on it. And you know how we're going to get access to those questions? We're going to pop balloons.
It was funny because my husband was like, you can't use your hands.
Yeah.
He made all the kids like try to sit on them or lay on them. And it was fun.
So, yeah. Yeah. That's good.
Anyway.
Well, that's fun. Yeah. That's fun. And you had a good time. You went to Tennessee for Christmas.
We did. And we drove there, and I didn't get COVID this year, people. It was awesome.
That's good. Anytime you can. As I'm talking, I'm realizing more and more I've got some congestion.
I don't think
it's COVID, but yeah, I think just some picked up a little schmutz, as they say, perhaps.
That's not a good way to enter the new year.
Yeah.
Although get rid of that.
It might be allergies or leftovers from allergies, because my mom, who I visit, has a cat, and I stay at her place. Ooh. So I take drugs for it, but sometimes I wonder if it takes a few days to kind of get flushed out of the system, so to speak.
I am not a cat person because I'm pretty allergic. But
yeah.
Are you a resolution guy? You make resolutions?
You know, the past few years, I haven't been very serious about it. I haven't been very serious about making resolutions.
Like you've been half serious about it?
I don't know. Like it's not like I reject the concept out of hand. You know, it's just more like people are like, are you making any resolutions? And I'm always like, I don't know. So I don't know. I have this vague sense of like, I think there's some good... Like that can be a good practice, you know, and then obviously I've seen ways that it becomes an unhelpful practice, but I think it can be a good practice. But then I don't know. I feel like I have the kind of personality that's always making resolutions. I think maybe that's it.
Yeah. I know, hear that.
Like I'm an Enneagram one. And so I'm always like, how am I going to be better? So every single day I have that impulse. And, so I don't know, maybe my instinct has been the last few years to say, you know what? I don't need to always be trying to get better. Like, maybe I can just relax.
There you go.
Anyway, maybe that's my resolution.
There you go. Relax.
Rest
chill.
And relax or something. Yeah.
I'll give you a word. I just do a word every year.
Yeah, right. I remember talking about this.
So my word this year is present, like being present.
Yeah.
I think I tend to like think about the past or think about the future and just want to be present to where I am.
That's good.
Yeah. And so I'm excited. There's some books I'm going to read and some practices I want to kind of implement into that. And so we'll see. I always look forward to kind of a new journey in an area. So
that is fun.
But that is I like to ask questions and kind of review the year. Mm-hmm. Glenn and Holly Packiam have a book. I think it's called The Intentional Year. Jenny Allen does like questions that she like. Anyway, I take these resources that people have and then kind of make my own and reflect and ask Paul questions. And it's good. I like to reset. So,
yeah. You know, someone in my church uses something called the Monk Manual.
Ooh, I've never heard of that.
I hadn't either. And it's the same thing that you just talked about there, where it's kind of this amalgamation of a lot of different questions and systems and processes that he's sort of picked up from various sources, but it's not just a yearly thing, but it's a daily thing. So every day you sort of reflect on three things you're thankful for, and you look to your tasks for the next day and try to implement, you know, you like highlight three of them or be like, okay, these are the most important things for tomorrow. And so it's kind of this combination of planning and journaling and reflecting and praying that is, I used it for a little while. it ended up feeling a little cumbersome to me, but this person in my church swears by it and loves it. So,
Cool. I'm going to have to look into it.
Yeah. Or Christy, you can make your own version of it.
I know, you know,
with all the different resources you've kind of collected, mm-hmm. like you could make a journal, yeah. a little That's like a good yearly. Idea.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about this later.
Okay. Okay. Well, right, but today we're going to dive into a podcast that actually yes. I was having issues with trying to record it at
Technical issues.
Technical not issues. Like
theological issues.
No. And so I didn't get to be a part of it. But yeah. Tell us about Bonnie.
We interviewed Bonnie Christian. She was one of our first interviews way back in the day. She had written another book called A Flexible Faith. She just wrote a new book called Untrustworthy, The Knowledge Crisis, Breaking Our Brains, Polluting Our Politics, and Corrupting Christian Community, which I don't know. I just kind of love the subtitle game of mm-hmm. some of these publishers. But essentially, it's kind of a wide-ranging book. It's interesting. It covers a lot of ground, but we talk with Bonnie about conspiracy theories, half-truths, kind of some of the stuff that has emerged over the last few years on social media, cable news, kind of these dubious news websites, you know, and all of this kind of thing, and how it's contributed to some of the problems that we see in society and in the church, and kind of what to do about it. I think she's got some helpful things to say, because I don't think there's anybody, you know, in America today who has not been affected by this. Like, we've got family members who, you know, buy into conspiracy theories. We've got family members and friends and such where relationships have been broken because of these things. And so I think it's an important and timely book. And we chat with Bonnie about that today.
Well, and I did jump in like at one point, like on there, because I asked a question about what do you do in this case? Like, how do you handle like relationships that you're like, whoa, you believe something totally different and how it causes friction. So anyway,
absolutely.
I'm excited to hear the beginning part because I missed it. So let's jump into it.
Okay. First podcast of 2023. Here we go. Hello, everyone. Bonnie Christian joins us on the Gravity Leadership Podcast today. Bonnie is a seasoned journalist who writes on foreign policy, religion, criminal justice, urbanism, civil liberties, electoral politics, and more. Her column, The Lesser Kingdom, appears in print and online at Christianity Today, and she is the author of A Flexible Faith, Rethinking What It Means to Follow Jesus Today, which is a book we interviewed her about a few years ago, and also the author of the book we're going to talk about today, which is called Untrustworthy, The Knowledge Crisis, Breaking Our Brains, Polluting Our Politics, and Corrupting Christian Community. Bonnie lives in Pittsburgh with her husband and twin boys. Bonnie, welcome back to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Yeah. Great to have you back again. I wondered, maybe as a first question, if you could talk about a little bit, we're going to get into the topics of the book here, but I wonder if you can talk about the genesis of this book. Where did this start for you, and why did you feel a need or a desire to write this?
Yeah, so a lot of it started, I think, with my work in journalism. I'm an opinion writer, and I sort of found myself returning to a lot of themes, I would say from like 2017, 2018 onward. Themes that had to do with media and like the technology of that, but also with truth and how we form opinions and how mm-hmm. we converse with each other across political differences. And gradually, you know, it wasn't sort of like a deliberate thing where I was trying to do a series or something. It was just driven by what was in the news, what was happening in the world. And so gradually I started to see those as pieces of a bigger theme, and I wanted to write about them in a little bit more durable format than, you know, an opinion piece that people will be tired and done with after 3 days. And so I thought a book. But it was also, you know, a more relational thing as well, where I was experiencing things in my own life and having conversation with friends who were experiencing very similar things. And mm-hmm. so it sort of became clear to me that this problem I was perceiving wasn't just sort of something in media spaces or in public spaces in politics, but also something that was affecting people very personally. And that was I was not the alone in that, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. I related to that as well. I've got a friend who, is constantly, you know, much like, Jim, in quotes, mm-hmm. That you write about in your introduction, but, a friend who's constantly seems to be taken in by half truths, you know, that he heard on cable news or conspiracy theories from dubious websites, shared on his social media feed. And sometimes, you know, I find it necessary to challenge him, you know, like we all kind of wrestle with, how to, you know, how to talk to people mm-hmm. who are saying things that are like clearly untrue and clearly sort of like fear-based and all that kind of thing. And every once in a while, you know, I'll challenge him about some of this stuff. And he usually sort of acquiesces at, oh, I didn't mm-hmm. realize, but then almost immediately expresses this deep, almost despair and incredulity about like, how am I supposed to know what to believe? Do I have to fact check everything? And how do I know if the fact checking websites are correct? And there's this, cynicism, I think, that sets mm-hmm. in that just makes it easier to just, you know, I'm just going to tune into, you know, this news channel and just kind of believe what's happening here, because to him, it all kind of looks the same, right? Mm-hmm. There's this text on the internet that I'm reading or these talking heads on TV. How do I figure out who's telling the truth? Your book basically argues that this is a widespread experience
for a lot of people. I've had conversations with older family members where like we're looking at some really sketchy website, maybe one of those that if you dig down to the about page, it says like, this is a work of satire, but of course it's not funny and it's not, you know, it's intended to fool you, not to make you laugh. And I'll immediately look at the page that they're showing me and be like, oh yeah, this is fake. Like, look at it. And they're like, what? And I'm like, you know, just the whole thing. And they're like, but what? And it's like, I don't know. If you can't see it, I can't tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's frustrating. What, how do we get ourselves into this mess?
I think, so a lot of the conversations we have around this are focused on like disinformation, misinformation. We talk about the quality of the information a lot and, you know, mm-hmm. we've done that a little bit here already, and that is really important. But I think in a lot of cases, and you gestured here already, it's really about quantity. In the last 20, 30 years, first with like the rise of 24-hour cable news and then with the internet and then social media as we know it now, we just enormously increased the quantity of information that we're encountering all day. Mm-hmm. Recently, I was talking with someone who said, you know, wouldn't it be nice if I just read like one news article a day and I could think about it and I could think about who wrote it and, you know, what are they likely to get right? What are they likely to get wrong? You know, does this affect my life? Can I do something about this and, you know, really meditate on that for the day? But of course, that's not how we operate, right? We read 30, 50, 100 news articles a day and share some large portion of those very possibly. And at that level, I think it's inevitable that it's overwhelming and that we're not really going to be capable of parsing the number of fact claims, the number of sometimes really big truth claims that we're encountering. And so we really rapidly, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's our whole lives if you're under a certain age, but rapidly changed the way that we encounter and consume information. And I think we just didn't prepare for that really in terms of how we would enter that space. And now it's very much coming back to bite us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now a word from a sponsor.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Bonnie, a couple things. One, I am not the friend Ben mentioned earlier, although
his name's Matt. Oh, shoot. I was supposed to give a different name.
Two, it's crazy. As we're speaking, a friend of mine, I forgot to, I quiet my computer, but my Facebook tab is still open. And a friend just sent me a YouTube video about Egyptian artifacts found in the Grand Canyon. And he said, I don't know if this is official or right, but this is part of the issue, right? There's 6 billion videos on YouTube claiming to have this truth. And something you just mentioned about sort of the overwhelming avalanche of inputs. David Bowie had this fascinating interview a few decades ago where he talked about the cost on human civilization that the internet would bring. And this was one of the things he mentioned, that we weren't made to function with this many inputs and that we would quickly basically outkick our coverage. We would, our hardware isn't made to run this many apps. How do you deal with that? So for instance, are there ways that you discipline your inputs? Are there places you go that you curate, like trustworthy sources? How do you navigate that avalanche?
Yeah. I mean, I try. I think it's something that I and probably a lot of us who tend to be online a lot will have to deal with for the rest of our lives. Like, I don't think this is something you just sort of set and forget and now you're fixed. Mm. A few things that I come back to really often are, one is taking stock of, if you're on social media, taking stock of your social media platforms and considering what kind of content you encounter where. One thing that I think is really deleterious is mixing content. So like on Instagram, I'm pretty much there for like photos of my friends, you know, houses and dogs and kids or whatever. And for that reason, I have unsubscribed from those story posts, you know, those ones that disappear in like 24 hours. Anyone who posts political stuff there regularly or like things that are not just updates from their lives, I unsubscribe from their stories because it becomes sort of morally absurd to click from like, here's my friend's kitten to here's my other friend's like petition to stop a genocide to here's a wedding photo to please vote or our country will end. Like you can't snap through that, you know, into 2 seconds and process those in any reasonable way. So that kind of like limiting things out. Also because I think when we get political content shared by our friends, we tend to sort of trust their judgment because, you know, they're our friends or they're our family members or whomever. But as we know, sometimes your friends and family members don't have great judgment. And so when I'm clicking on some video or news article that was brought to me by someone I know and trust, I'm going into that maybe with my guard down and not really scrutinizing it. I'm just sort of accepting it. So that's one thing. Another thing that I recommend is, and that I try to do myself, is just like time limits and order limits. So a rule that I have stolen from a book called The Common Rule is scripture before phone. So like trying to not start the morning on Twitter, basically. Trying to start it even if it just means like reading a really quick psalm or something to set the day that way. And then just recently I had to go back again and like log out of Twitter on my phone. And I have like a security thing set up that will be enough of a hassle that I'm not going to go to the trouble of logging back in again, at least for a while, things like that. Mm-hmm. And then a third thing that I point to a lot is, and I do this as a journalist, but I think it's also really important as a news consumer, is limit the number of topics that you pay attention to and know well. When we're thinking about that avalanche of information, if you are trying to sort of keep up on all the headlines and have a light knowledge of everything that's going on in the world, I think that makes you much more susceptible to confusion and deception. Whereas if you pick maybe 3, 4, 5 topics like, you know, I don't know, immigration policy, the war in Ukraine, sort of something big like that, right? But that you would follow long term, that you would maybe even read a book about, not just the daily headlines.
Wait, a whole book?
You can, yeah, a whole book. You can build, don't worry, you can look at your phone between chapters. Oh, you can,
I think she means a tweet about the book. I think that's what she means.
A summary.
You can build up that background information so that when you come across a YouTube video, you can be like, oh, no, this is nonsense. Like, I know about this and this is not it. And you can't build up that kind of background knowledge on everything. It's just not possible. So limits of topics, limits of time, and I think limits of platform are all really important.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really helpful, I think, because that does seem to be just the honoring of human limits our limited ability to take in information, our limited ability to do good in the world. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of this, for people that I know, that myself included, like, I think we're trying to do some good in the world. Like, we're trying mm-hmm. to know about the war in Ukraine and immigration policy and what's happening with, like, we're trying to know about these things because we feel like there's something important at stake, right? Justice issues and that kind of a thing. But honoring our own limits in those, even in our ability to kind of do good in the yeah. world, I think is a really healthy thing.
And I think there's not a contradiction between saying, you know, this issue is really important. Mm-hmm. I don't have the capacity to do anything about it or to be knowledgeable about that. I know other people are working on that, and I'm yeah. going to, you know, leave that to them and prioritize this thing that maybe I can do something about.
Yeah.
You know, okay. it doesn't mean that you don't care about justice in an area just because that is not an area that you personally can't address in your life. You can't do yeah. everything.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk a bit about, you mentioned social media and limiting social media. I'd love to talk okay. a little bit about social media, because this is something I've been thinking about for a while, with Matt, with other friends, that I wonder if you can comment on. I know you've got a whole, section of the book that talks about social media, and this is a super interesting time to talk about this. This podcast won't release until 2023 probably, but we are recording this during the fourth week of Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter, and I don't know, it, probably most of our listeners aren't following this, but it is crazy what's been happening. And so who knows, Twitter might not even exist by the time this gets released. I don't know. But I wonder if you can talk about, so in your book, you rightly, I think, critique social media, the way that it's set up the way that it's set up kind of creates, it adds to this problem for us, right? By the same token, I've heard from marginalized people, Black people in particular, that social media has been helpful for them in sort of democratizing public discourse in a way where there's just as much access that they have to write a tweet, you know, or mm-hmm. respond to an issue as, so sort of they've found it freeing to go outside the traditional communication channels, in order for their voices to be heard. So I'm wondering, I don't know if you have anything, to say about this, but I am wondering if there is something to be said about keeping that perspective in mind about some of the helpful ways that social media has done those things, while also rightfully critiquing some of what social media has done to our public discourse.
Yeah. I mean, so I'm not like a social media absolutist, right? Like I have a mm-hmm. Twitter account, I have an Instagram account.
Right.
I wouldn't say that it has zero value or benefits. I am a little skeptical of those arguments, in terms of, you know, the idea that making your voice heard on social media is typically affecting any concrete change in the world. Mm. You know, it might feel good, I think, to tweet. Did anything actually come of it, though? Did any public official actually change their policy because of your tweets? You know, in many cases, were you even able to change your recalcitrant uncle's mind? Right. Probably not, yeah. right? I yeah. think we have yeah. an overinflated sense of what our social media activity does. And I mean, I include myself in that. I mm-hmm. go on there and hope that I'm selling books or hope that I'm getting people to read my articles. In practice, like when you look at the analytics and a lot of this stuff, people are not actually doing the things you want them to do. Mm. And I think that's even more true of bigger asks like policy changes than it is of like, please click this link and read the yeah. thing I wrote. Yeah. So, you know, again, it's not there's zero value on social media. There is. And I know many people have, you know, important relationships that have started on social media. They have had important like career things. And I would include myself in this, important career developments that have come out of social media. It's not that there can be nothing good there. But I think that we went into it with a lot of naivete about how this would change the world and how it would democratize things and it would make public officials so much more accessible to us. And this far into the experiment, I think on a lot of those things, the net balance is more negative than positive, even if certainly you can find users who are having a positive experience.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's helpful because I think... I'll just say like one of the eye-opening things for me about this, and you address this in the book, but mm-hmm. just the way that it's set up is to benefit the company that owns the social media platform. Like the way that it's set up is not to provide every, there's no altruistic motive behind social media. Now, if it was owned by the public and, you know, it was really thought of as a common square, sure, maybe, but there's a profit motive here. And so they profit if your eyeballs stay on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. And I think that just knowing that, has helped, I don't know, I hope it's helped me to become a bit more of a savvy social media user, and it doesn't maybe affect me in, or I can notice it when it is starting to affect me in the ways that they're hoping it does. And I can say, oh, wait a second, do I want to cooperate with this impulse to spend the rest of the afternoon on Twitter, or do I want to do something else with my time?
Yeah, this is something that is really interesting with the, you know, the Elon Musk's $8 a month plan. Because the way that social media works now is very much about like use time, like minutes that you're logging on the site and putting your eyeballs there, and how much of it your attention do you give it? Yeah. Maybe if it was dependent on like a subscription fee, maybe some of those incentives could change where they could make a profit without totally corrupting your brain. So I don't know. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe there is a model of social media that's less corrosive to how we like think about the world and process information. I don't think that we've gotten there yet.
Yeah.
Bonnie, I'm curious if we just go right into an actual like thing that happens in my life. But I have friends, actually have a relative. We'll keep it like incognito. We won't say who it is. But
Is it Matt?
It's not. It's not Matt. Okay. It's my friend Matt Bebby. No, I'm just kidding. but they are, you know, they believe in conspiracy theories, and it's significantly disruptive to their ability to relate. Why do people get taken in by conspiracy theories, and how do we effectively combat it with our friends and our relatives? Can you kind of speak to that a little bit?
That's a tricky one, and probably one of the things that I get asked most often. As far as why they're attractive, I think, you know, on the most sympathetic end of things is that sometimes they're true, and especially people who came of age in the 70s, like that was a huge decade for exposure of real conspiracies that happened. And I think if that's sort of like your entrance, and this is boomers basically, right? If that's your entrance into politics, you're sort of primed to be open to that. Mm. Beyond that, though, you know, even with fake theories, I think that there are a couple other pieces of attraction. One is that like they make a lot of sense to people a lot of times. It's a tidy explanation. It provides a way to sort of fix a lot of things at once, and often, you know, very like legitimately bad things that you should want to fix. Mm-hmm. And so that can be sort of comforting, even though it's generating fear at the same time, like it's comforting, right? To know that if you could just get those bad people, this thing would go away. Mm. And then the internet has added this new dimension where it's often really communal. Like you see this a lot with this is a big thing with the QAnon conspiracy. It's like it's a movement. It's not just a theory. You have sometimes really good friends there. And especially if your behavior has started alienating people in real life, like you're describing, then those friendships become even more valuable and hard to give up. Mm. So I think it's attractive for a lot of reasons. And I think that sense to which it plays to feelings and to which it involves friendships also is why it's really hard to get people out of it. Because particularly now where the way conspiracy theories tend to work these days, and again, I would use QAnon as an example, is there's not a lot of theory. It has a lot in common with like a role, like a video game or one of those games where you search for clues. So it's really gamified. It's fun. You do it with your friends. And the details don't super matter. So trying to argue someone out of it, even if they concede one point, they're just going to come up with something else. Mm-hmm. And that will be endless, and you'll never be able to keep up, even if you spend so much time doing it. And so, yeah, that is why, like, as much as it sort of galls me, because, I mean, I argue things for a living. I want argument to work.
Yes.
It's why I keep coming back to recommending that you don't really try to argue with people. And that, insofar as is possible, and obviously sometimes they make this really difficult, but that you talk about other things and you do other things, mm-hmm. like normal things that maybe in the long run can remind them that there are other and better things going on and things that they can actually affect and enjoy. And then one of the pastors I interviewed for the book recommended that at some point, if you have like a solid enough relational basis, you could ask them, what sort of fruit is this producing in your life? And that maybe in some cases people will be like open to that question and open to the realization that can produce. But I think that's something that you get to after a long time, not when they're sort of in the heat of it and real excited about this new thing they've found.
We'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Let's get back to the show. Yeah, you mentioned the 70s and like Watergate and all the Jagger mm-hmm. Hoover stuff that came out about the FBI. And so
MK Ultra, tons of fun stuff.
Yeah, tons of stuff. And then those of us in Gen X, like I grew up watching The X-Files where it was just one long show about a conspiracy, right? And it seems like, you know, Egyptian artifacts found in the bottom of the Grand Canyon or The X-Files are like these a little more harmless conspiracies. Right? Mm-hmm. Versus these Egyptian artifacts were buried in the Grand Canyon by Mitt Romney and Nancy Pelosi, and they're there for the reptilian aliens so they can unearth them. So we therefore have to kill Mitt Romney and Nancy Pelosi. Like, it seems like we can delineate or differentiate between harmless mm-hmm. conspiracy theories and conspiracy theories that, like you said, bear bad fruit, lead to mm-hmm. actual injustice and harm in the world. Yeah, mm-hmm. Bonnie, is that part of this too?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, you know, if you have someone who insists that the moon landing was fake, like, probably whatever, who cares? You can think they're wrong, they can think you're wrong, it's probably not going to matter if they're, like, in the Capitol building with horns on. Maybe things are a little different at that point.
A different kind of theory.
In terms of the approach you should be taking. And I think that's part of why it's so difficult, right? Because for a long time, conspiracy theories, as most of us encountered them, probably were in that more like harmless crank variety where people, there wasn't really any action to take. Like, what would they do because of it? It was just sort of like an annoying thing they talked about from time to time. Whereas, again, because of the internet now, they can find other people and start to say, who believe the same thing, and start to say, like, well, what could we do about this?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a term I was introduced to from a recent Andrew Whitehead article. He was talking about Christian nationalism and sort of why it persists. And he used the term false consensus. Hmm. Where if you're only gathering with people who believe about the same things that you do, you have this feeling in your community and in your body that everybody believes. It's clear. Mm-hmm. It's easy to see this, you know, because you, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that's the other sort of dark side of the connectivity, right? Is like, I can go find a community on Reddit or, you know, a group of people on Twitter that, well, yeah, we all see things the same way. And if I'm going to talk to Christy about this stuff, she's just going to challenge me or want me to, you know, talk about her kids instead. But, mm-hmm. I get fed from this, this online community that, we all kind of can post stuff and, hey, did you hear about this? And it feels good to sort of belong mm-hmm. to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I appreciated, Bonnie, about this book is it's practical. At the end, you do try to, you know, how do we deal with friends and relatives who, you know, believe conspiracy theories and things like that? What do we do ourselves to try to bring some semblance of, you know, sanity to our discourse and that kind of things? And I think, you know, maybe the two ditches that are easy for people to fall into when kind of faced with this knowledge crisis. One is the friend I mentioned who is not Matt Tebbe at the beginning, where his temptation was to fall into despair. He didn't want to really think about how bad this problem was because it just made him think, well, I can't have known if anything's true and that's too hard for me. And I think the other, you know, the other ditch is maybe falling into sort of doubling down on false certainty. And so I like that your book sort of provides a way forward. And I really liked the chapter called A Practical Epistemology. I really liked that term, because I do think it takes some of the, anyway, there's a lot more to it than we can probably get into on this podcast. But I just want to comment on this and see if you have anything that you'd like to say about it. But I love that you included love as an important element of a practical epistemology. And you quote N.T. Wright, who talks about an epistemology of love and knowing things by loving things. And so I wonder if you could just say something about that. Like, why is love important for knowing the truth?
Yeah, well, I mean, you mentioned I quoted N.T. Wright. I think that's very much stealing from him there, standing on his shoulders. But his idea is basically that, you know, when we love something, we're approaching it as it is, not as we want it to be, or not as something that we can use for ourselves. And so thinking about knowledge that way, and the two ditches that you mentioned, right? So, like, if we love something, we're not going to fall into the sort of overwhelmed, like, cynicism, giving up side of things, because we care about it and we want to be engaged with it. And so, you know, there's that urge against giving up. But on the other hand, just doubling down and believing what we want to be true, that is an example of using the information, not really searching for the truth, but searching for things that help us or that help our cause. And so, yeah, I think it's certainly, we can see where love has a role on the relational side of this. But I thought that it was really striking the way he talked about it, on that more intellectual or knowledge focused side of things. It is a connection that I feel like we don't make very often.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to think about that, because I think there is this overwhelming temptation for us to use facts for our cause, you know, and we all believe our cause is righteous, but to love the truth because it's true is something that I do think that Jesus points us back to, and that, you know, politicians, you know, from Pilate all the way to Rudy Giuliani, like, have always tried to be cynical about that, right? Like, what is truth, Pilate says, or I can't remember what Giuliani says, you quote him in the book, but, you know, something like, you know,
truth isn't truth,
you know, or alternative facts, or, you know, that kind of thing. And so, but there's this, like, feeding of that cynicism to say, like, there's no such thing as truth. So there's nothing to love here. There's only power interests, and we're just using facts, you know, words to just advance our cause. And, I think the change that's been surprising to me is just seeing how out in the open that is. Right now. So, like, there are people, the politicians, political strategists, who are openly admitting that's the strategy, is we just say whatever we need to say to galvanize the people to kind of vote for us and keep us in power. And it's just, anyway, you can tell my temptation is the cynical one. So
it's hard to know, like, are they just more open about it now? Was it always this bad? But, you know, people are a little more smooth, a little more willing to sort of hide their work. And I don't know the answer to that. My inclination is to say that there was always a lot of this, but that the way, like, that very democratizing effect of social media encourages more of us to do it and sort of makes it happen more often. So in that sense, makes it more visible and more unavoidable and makes the people who do lean towards cynicism, like, it's, you know, it's easier to say, like, I can't keep up with this. I can't sort through all this. There's just too much. You're openly stating you want to deceive me. So I give up.
It's true. Yeah.
Well, Bonnie, maybe we can close with this, but I'm curious, you know, someone picks up your book and they read it. What are you hoping they walk away with?
I think the biggest thing I'm hoping is that when it's getting towards that practical section in the end, that, you know, and I'm asking people to really look at their habits and the way that they've even, like, arranged the physical spaces in their home, that they're actually looking at that. And I think especially that they're looking at that in terms of, like, children, if they have them. Like, my kids are 3, so they're too young for this to really be an issue yet. But I think I mentioned earlier, I think this is something like those of us who are adults already, who are already online too much, this is something we'll be dealing with for the rest of our lives. But maybe that experience at least makes us more knowledgeable to think about what are the pitfalls here and what are the decisions I should be making, like for my children, so that they are maybe not dealing with it in quite the same way for the rest of their lives. And obviously you can't anticipate how technology will change and what the challenges will be. But I think a lot of the like habits to make space for the growth of intellectual virtues that I discuss are things that will be applicable even as new technologies are coming along. I'm due to speak to with a high school class tomorrow morning. Okay. And they sent along some questions in advance. And the top question was something like, why do you want to keep your kids off the internet? Isn't it a good thing with so much information? And I just had to laugh. Like, you know, I mean, I love the internet too, but no, I'm not going to let my, you know, especially preteen child just run wild on YouTube, right? Nope. And that's something that I think those of us who have come to realize that we have a real problem here can hopefully handle better with future generations.
I think that's your next book, Bonnie. I have six kids, and I think you need to make this a kid version of this because, man, I think a lot of parents have a lot of questions. They're dealing with it in their own lives, but then they're also trying to figure out, how do I parent my child? Because the same things that they're struggling with, their 15-year-old or 12-year-old or whatever is struggling with too. So anyway, that's my idea.
Thank you.
There we go.
That seems like a harder book to write, honestly. Yeah.
Yes, I think so too. Well, Bonnie, this book covers so much ground. A lot of well-researched nuance on all kinds of stuff. I was really impressed with your writing on cancel culture, the death of expertise, the role of emotions and experience in our discourse. So obviously we can't cover all of that, which is why, listeners, you should read this book. It's really helpful. Thanks for writing it, Bonnie. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
How can people connect with you online?
I am on the internet.
Yeah, you are on the internet, so.
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Twitter is probably the most active at Bonnie Christian. I also have a Substack, bonniechristian.substack.com, which has been pretty book focused right now. And I would say, especially if you have questions after reading, by all means, subscribe and send me your questions, and I'd love to answer them in an email for subscribers. It's free. There's no paid feature, at least as of this time.
Okay.
Lots of places to find me.
Okay. Well, thanks for spending some time with us again, Bonnie. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
What is your favorite conspiracy theory? That's what I want to know.
Is a favorite conspiracy theory like an entertaining conspiracy theory? Or is it one that you think might be true?
Okay, it can be any.
Both of those could be true together.
Yeah.
This was true because it's so entertaining.
I'll give you mine first.
Okay.
My favorite... E.T. came out in 1982. I was like six, and my parents let me watch it, and it scared the stink out of me.
Yeah, it was a scary movie.
Oh my goodness, I can't believe they let me watch it. So anyway, I grew up fascinated by aliens, and my favorite conspiracy theory has to do with, like, the United States has, you know, recovered like spaceships.
Right.
And they use that technology.
UFOs
in the 50s. Now I don't think I don't think it's true, but I really
See that question at the end of your voice there?
Yeah.
You think it might be?
I mean, so that one's a big one. The one that obviously the QAnon stuff is really awful, but I will say I'm going to use a Christian swear, everybody.
Oh boy.
Gird up your ear holes. The crap they get people to believe. Mm-hmm. Like reptilian people and drinking blood is first of all awful, but secondly, you almost have to say, well done. Like, I don't know, you're doing such a good job at this. You really went for it.
You're just like, you know what? Let's just think of the most ridiculous thing we can, and let's see if they'll. And it's like, I guess so.
Yeah, so those are probably my two.
Yeah. I am quite fond of aliens as well. I love alien sci-fi. And so I think that might be mine as well, just that aliens are already here. They've already landed. We were already communicating with some sort of aliens. I like that as a conspiracy theory. It's interesting to me. So,
okay, do you know what's happening to me right now?
What's happening to you?
What's happening to me is that because there are people that I dearly love that are like up to their eyeballs in conspiracy theory, that when you ask me what my favorite one is, it like kind of breaks my heart because I'm like, this is like, I think of a person who actually believes like in like their life is different and altered because of what they believe about these things, that it's like really unsettling to me. And I wonder, anyway, I'm saying that just because that's what's happening, but
yeah, maybe there's listeners who feel that way too.
Yeah.
I could understand that.
Yeah. All that to say, I don't have a favorite.
Don't have a favorite.
All right.
You love them all equally.
That's fair.
Yeah, and I'm a favorite person, but like...
Now you do like favorite things.
Favorites of everything, but not like having conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you guys heard... You guys remember that that worship guy, David Crowder?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
The big beard?
Yeah.
I like him.
The big beard. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you guys hear the conspiracy theory that his parents were in the Manson family?
What? No.
And he was raised, and he's like part of the Manson family still, and he's sort of like covertly leading worship, like to undermine Christian stuff.
Wow, I haven't heard about this.
That's messed up.
It is messed up. Well, I just made that up. Do you think it would work if I put that out there?
Yeah,
think people would believe.
I mean, maybe it might be easily falsifiable by research, but
who does research anymore?
That didn't stop other conspiracy theories.
This is true.
Sorry, I hope we're not undoing Bonnie's work. Her very good work in her book. It just, there's so many of these stories out there.
Yeah.
Can I share one more conspiracy theory that I love? I know we're going long. when I was in high school, AP history, I was like, I had to do a report on somebody, and my teacher's like, you should read about Rasputin.
Oh, yeah.
Rasputin was this Orthodox priest who basically could heal the Tsar's daughter's hemophilia, and basically he basically was like a Don Juan, like Rico Suave guy. Like he would sleep with tons of people, but he had healing powers. And then when they tried to kill him, they like shot him a dozen times, gave him like six times the arsenic that was needed to kill somebody, and he was still alive. Like that, those are the kinds of stories that fascinate me. Like, How does this guy who lived about 140 years ago, what was going on with him? What's up with him? That's not really a conspiracy theory.
Are those stories real or are they, yeah?
Well, these stories are real. Like his murder, if you just go Google Rasputin's murder. Oh,
you are just asking our listeners to Google things.
If you just Google, just Wikipedia
Rasputin.
Bonnie
just told us to get off the internet.
Get off the internet.
All right, we probably should.
And now go Google it.
We probably should get out of here.
That stuff is fascinating for me as well.
Yeah, so. You guys, I didn't tell you this yet, but my grief counselor died yesterday.
What?
Yep. Yeah, he was so good that I don't even care.
Matt, that one. No, sir. Listeners, I apologize. I'm half met Tevi.
Maybe I am the friend you were talking about, Ben.
Yeah, it could be.
Oh,
maybe I'm the troublemaker.
I've been
trying
to work up the courage to have an intervention to talk with you. So.
Yes. Yeah. All right, friends.
I do want to say, listeners, I already said this, but the book is really good. The book is it's well researched. It's just a good, well rounded book. So if you're interested in these topics, I would encourage you to pick it up. Probably enough for now. Yeah. Unless you guys want to talk about cars. When was the last time that each of you was in a car dealership, like looking at a new car? Like, when did you have to buy a car last?
10 years ago.
It's nice. More than that for me.
Yeah. Well, can I tell you a story real quick?
You can't. This feels like a trap, Christy.
It feels like a bad joke.
All right, here we go.
Let me tell you a story.
Your grief counselor?
I was, the last time I was, my grief counselor died. No.
I don't even care.
I was in a car dealership with my grief counselor. No.
Sorry.
I was in a, last time I was in a, like looking for a car, I overheard this conversation that I wanted to tell you about. And there was a couple looking at this car and they were talking to the salesman. And they were just asking them various questions about the car. And they said, what about cargo space? And the salesman looked at them a little bit confused and just said, well, I'm sorry, but car no can do that. Cargo road.
It's contagious.
I do feel like my I do feel like my joke was a fart. And then I feel like Ben like ate my fart and then burped it back into everybody's face.
It is so good that I am like over 1,000 miles away. I do not want that rubbing off on me.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, man.
All right, everybody.
I definitely want that one though. That was such a good joke. I giggle about that one. I heard that one yesterday and I just think about it and I giggle. Just
trouble.
Cargo can do that. Cargo road.
Oh my goodness.
All right. Well,
on that note, friends.
On that note, yeah. Yeah.
If that doesn't get you back next week, we're out of ideas.
Mm-hmm. You'll notice, listeners, that Christy felt the need to apologize for Matt, but not for me. So,
mm-hmm. Oh, gosh. Right. I'm just flabbergasted.
Flabbergasted. Yeah. All right.
No.
All right, listeners. See you next week. Peace.
See you.
Peace.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful or enjoyable, we'd love it if you'd tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And you can join our Gravity community online for free at gravityleadership.com/join.
You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as our email most Fridays with curated links to articles we find interesting and helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the show. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Recording button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.